you pay attention. An author makes you notice, makes you pay attention. And this is a great gift. My gratitude for good writing is unbounded. I'm grateful for it the way I'm grateful for the ocean. Aren't you? I ask. Most of them nod. This is why they're here. They love to read. They love good writing. They want to do it, too. But a few of the students are still looking at me with a sense of betrayal or hopelessness, as if they're thinking of hanging themselves. Too late for a refund, I tell them cheerfully. But I have something even better. Next are the two single most helpful things I can tell you about writing. Short assignments. The first useful concept is the idea of short assignments. Often when you sit down to write, what you have in mind is an autobiographical novel about your childhood, or a play about the immigrant experience, or a history of, say, women. But this is like trying to scale a glacier. It's hard to get your footing, and your fingertips get all red and frozen and torn up. Then your mental illnesses arrive at the desk like your sickest, most secretive relatives, and they pull up chairs in a semicircle around the computer, and they try to be quiet, but you know they're there with their weird, coppery breath leering at you behind your back. What I do at this point, as the panic mounts and the jungle drums begin beating and I realize that the well has run dry and that my future is behind me and I'm going to have to get a job, only I'm completely unemployable, is to stop. First, I try to breathe, because I'm either sitting there panting like a lap dog or I'm unintentionally making slow asthmatic death rattles. So I just sit there for a minute, breathing slowly, quietly. I let my mind wander. After a moment, I may notice that I'm trying to decide whether or not I am too old for orthodontia and whether right now would be a good time to make a few calls. And then I start to think about learning to use makeup and how maybe I could find some boyfriend who is not a total and complete fixer-upper, and then my life would be totally great, and I'd be happy all the time. And then I think about all the people I should have called back before I sat down to work, and how I should probably at least check in with my agent and tell him this great idea I have, and see if he thinks it's a good idea, and see if he thinks I need orthodontia, if that is what he is actually thinking whenever we have lunch together. Then I think about someone I'm really annoyed with, or some financial problem that is driving me crazy, and decide that I must resolve this before I get down to today's work. So I become a dog with a chew toy, worrying it for a while, wrestling it to the ground, flinging it over my shoulder, chasing it, licking it, chewing it, flinging it back over my shoulder. I stop just short of actually barking, but all of this only takes somewhere between 1 and 2 minutes, so I haven't actually wasted that much time. Still, it leaves me winded. I go back to trying to breathe slowly and calmly, and I finally notice the 1-inch picture frame that I put on my desk to remind me of short assignments. It reminds me that all I have to do is to write down as much as I can see through a 1-inch picture frame. This is all I have to bite off for the time being. All I'm going to do right now, for example, is write that one paragraph that sets the story in my hometown in the late 50s when the trains were still running. I'm going to paint a picture of it in words on my word processor. Or all I'm going to do is to describe the main character the very first time we meet her, when she first walks out the front door and onto the porch. I'm not even going to describe the expression on her face when she first notices the blind dog sitting behind the wheel of her car, just what I can see through the 1-inch picture frame. Just one paragraph describing this woman in the town where I grew up, the first time we encounter her. E.L. Doctorow once said that writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can see only as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. You don't have to see where you're going. You don't have to see your destination or everything you will pass along the way. You just have to see 2 or 3 feet ahead of you. This is right up there with the best advice about writing or life I've ever heard. So, after I've completely exhausted myself thinking about the people I most resent in the world and my more arresting financial problems and, of course, the orthodontia, I remember to pick up the 1-inch picture frame and to figure out a 1-inch piece of my story to tell. One small scene, one memory, one exchange. also remember a story that I know I've told elsewhere, but that over and over helps me to get a grip. 30 years ago, my older brother, who was 10 years old at the time, was trying to get a report on birds written that he'd had 3 months to write, which was due the next day. We were out at our family cabin in Bolinas, and he was at the kitchen table close to tears, surrounded by binder paper and pencils and unopened books on birds, immobilized by the hugeness of the task ahead. Then my father sat down beside him, put his arm around my brother's shoulder, and said, "Bird by bird, buddy. Just take it bird by bird." I tell this story again because it usually makes a dent in the tremendous sense of being overwhelmed that my students experience. Sometimes it actually gives them hope. And hope, as Chesterton said, is the power of being cheerful in circumstances that we know to be desperate. Writing can be a pretty desperate endeavor because it is about some of our deepest needs. Our need to be visible, to be heard, our need to make sense of our lives, to wake up and grow and belong. It is no wonder if we sometimes tend to take ourselves perhaps a bit too seriously. So, here is another story I tell often. In the Bill Murray movie, Stripes, in which he joins the army, there is a scene that takes place in the first night of boot camp, where Murray's platoon is assembled in the barracks. They're supposed to be getting to know their sergeant, played by Warren Oates, and one another. So each man takes a few moments to say a few things about who he is and where he's from. Finally, it is the turn of this incredibly intense, angry guy named Francis. "My name is Francis," he says. "No one calls me Francis. Anyone here calls me Francis, and I'll kill them. And another thing, I don't like to be touched. Anyone here ever tries to touch me, I'll kill him." At which point Warren Oates jumps in and says, "Hey, lighten up, Francis." This is not a bad line to have taped to the wall of your office. Say to yourself in the kindest possible way, "Look, honey, all we're going to do for now is to write a description of the river at sunrise, or the young child swimming in the pool at the club, or the first time the man sees the woman he will marry. That is all we're going to do for now. We are just going to take this bird by bird. But we are going to finish this one short assignment." Shitty first drafts. Now, practically even better news than that of short assignments is the idea of shitty first drafts. All good writers write them. This is how they end up with good second drafts and terrific third drafts. People tend to look at successful writers, writers who are getting their books published and maybe even doing well financially, and think that they sit down at their desks every morning feeling like $1 million, feeling great about who they are and how much talent they have and what a great story they have to tell, that they take in a few deep breaths, push back their sleeves, roll their necks a few times, get all the cricks out, and dive in, typing fully formed passages as fast as a court reporter. But this is just the fantasy of the uninitiated. I know some very great writers, writers you love who write beautifully and have made a great deal of money, and not one of them sits down routinely feeling wildly enthusiastic and confident. Not one of them writes elegant first drafts. All right, one of them does, but we do not like her very much. We do not think that she has a richer inner life or that God likes her or can even stand her. Although, when I mentioned this to my priest friend Tom, he said, "You can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do." Very few writers really know what they're doing until they've done it. Nor do they go about their business feeling dewy and thrilled. They do not type a few stiff warm-up sentences and then find themselves bounding along like huskies across the snow. One writer I know tells me that he sits down every morning and says to himself, nicely, "It's not like you don't have a choice, because you do. You can either type or kill yourself." We all often feel like we are pulling teeth, even those writers whose prose ends up being the most natural and fluid. The right words and sentences just do not come pouring out like ticker tape most of the time. Now, Muriel Spark is said to have felt that she was taking dictation from God every morning. Sitting there, one supposes, plugged into a dictaphone, typing away, humming, but This is a very hostile and aggressive position. One might hope for bad things to rain down on a person like this. For me, and most of the other writers I know, writing is not rapturous. In fact, the only way I can get anything written at all is to write really, really shitty first drafts. The first draft is the child's draft, where you let it all pour out and then let it romp all over the place, knowing that no one is going to see it and that you can shape it later. You just let this childlike part of you channel whatever voices and visions come through and onto the page. If one of the characters wants to say, "Well, so what, Mr. Poopy Pants?" you let her. No one is going to see it. If the kid wants to get into really sentimental, weepy, emotional territory, you let him. Just get it all down on paper, because there may be something great in those six crazy pages that you would never have gotten to by more rational grown-up means. There may be something in the very last line of the very last paragraph on page six that you just love, that is so beautiful or wild that you now know what you're supposed to be writing about, more or less, or in what direction you might go. But there was no way to get to this without first getting through the first 5.5 pages. I used to write food reviews for California Magazine before it folded. My writing food reviews had nothing to do with the magazine folding, although every single review did cause a couple of canceled subscriptions. Some readers took umbrage at my comparing mounds of vegetable puree with various ex-presidents' brains. These reviews always took 2 days to write. First, I'd go to a restaurant several times with a few opinionated, articulate friends in tow. I'd sit there writing down everything anyone said that was at all interesting or funny. Then, on the following Monday, I'd sit down at my desk with my notes and try to write the review. Even after I'd been doing this for years, panic would set in. I'd try to write a lead, but instead I'd write a couple of dreadful sentences. X them out, try again, X everything out, and then feel despair and worry settle on my chest like an X-ray apron. "It's over," I'd think, calmly. "I'm not going to be able to get the magic to work this time. I'm ruined. I'm through. I'm toast. Maybe," I'd think, "I can get my old job back as a clerk typist, but probably not." I'd get up, study my teeth in the mirror for a while. Then I'd stop, remember to breathe, make a few phone calls, hit the kitchen, and chow down. Eventually, I'd go back and sit down at my desk and sigh for the next 10 minutes. Finally, I would pick up my 1-inch picture frame, stare into it as if for the answer, and every time the answer would come. All I had to do was to write a really shitty first draft of, say, the opening paragraph, and no one was going to see it. So I'd start writing without reining myself in. It was almost just typing, just making my fingers move. And the writing would be terrible. I'd write a lead paragraph that was a whole page, even though the entire review could only be 3 pages long. And then I'd start writing up descriptions of the food, one dish at a time, bird by bird. And the critics would be sitting on my shoulders, commenting like cartoon characters. They'd be pretending to snore or rolling their eyes at my overwrought descriptions. No matter how hard I tried to tone those descriptions down, no matter how conscious I was of what a friend said to me gently in my early days of restaurant reviewing, "Annie," she said, "it is just a piece of chicken. It is just a bit of cake." But because by then I had been writing for so long, I would eventually let myself trust the process. Sort of, more or less. I'd write a first draft that was maybe twice as long as it should be, with a self-indulgent, boring beginning, stupefying descriptions of the meal, lots of quotes from my black-humored friends that made them sound more like the Manson girls than food lovers, and no ending to speak of. The whole thing would be so long and incoherent and hideous that for the rest of the day I'd obsess about getting creamed by a car before I could write a decent second draft. I'd worry that people would read what I'd written and believe that the accident had really been a suicide, that I had panicked because my talent was waning and my mind was shot. The next day, though, I'd sit down, go through it all with a colored pen, take out everything I possibly could, find a new lead somewhere on the second page, figure out a kicky place to end it, and then write a second draft. It always turned out fine, sometimes even funny and weird and helpful. I'd go over it one more time and mail it in. Then, a month later, when it was time for another review, the whole process would start again, complete with the fears that people would find my first draft before I could rewrite it. Almost all good writing begins with terrible first efforts. You need to start somewhere. Start by getting something, anything, down on paper. A friend of mine says that the first draft is the down draft. You just get it down. The second draft is the updraft. You fix it up. You try to say what you have to say more accurately. And the third draft is the dental draft, where you check every tooth to see if it's loose or cramped or decayed or even, God help us, healthy. What I've learned to do when I sit down to work on a shitty first draft is to quiet the voices in my head. First, there's the vinegar-lipped reader lady, who says primly, "Well, that's not very interesting, is it?" And there's the emaciated German male who writes these Orwellian memos detailing your thought crimes. And there are your parents agonizing over your lack of loyalty and discretion. And there's William Burroughs dozing off or shooting up because he finds you as bold and articulate as a houseplant and so on. And there are also the dogs. Let's not forget the dogs. The dogs in their pen who will surely hurtle and snarl their way out if you ever stop writing because writing is, for some of us, the latch that keeps the door of the pen closed, keeps those crazy, ravenous dogs contained. Quieting these voices is at least half the battle I fight daily. But this is better than it used to be. It used to be 87%. Left to its own devices, my mind spends much of its time having conversations with people who aren't there. I walk along defending myself to people, or exchanging repartee with them, or rationalizing my behavior, or seducing them with gossip, or pretending I'm on their TV talk show or whatever. I speed or run an aging yellow light or don't come to a full stop, and one nanosecond later I'm explaining to imaginary cops exactly why I had to do what I did and insisting that I did not, in fact, do it. I happened to mention this to a hypnotist I saw many years ago, and he looked at me very nicely. At first I thought he was feeling around on the floor for the silent alarm button, but then he gave me the following exercise, which I still use to this day. Close your eyes and get quiet for a minute until the chatter starts up. Then, isolate one of the voices and imagine the person speaking as a mouse. Pick it up by the tail and drop it into a mason jar. Then, isolate another voice. Pick it up by the tail, drop it in the jar, and so on. Drop in any high-maintenance parental units. Drop in any contractors, lawyers, colleagues, children, anyone who is whining in your head. Then put the lid on and watch all these mouse people clawing at the glass, jabbering away, trying to make you feel like shit because you won't do what they want, won't give them more money, won't be more successful, won't see them more often. Then imagine that there is a volume control button on the bottle. Turn it all the way up for a minute and listen to the stream of angry, neglected, guilt-mongering voices. Then turn it all the way down and watch the frantic mice lunge at the glass trying to get to you. Leave it down and get back to your shitty first draft. A writer friend of mine suggests opening the jar and shooting them all in the head, but I think he's a little angry. And I'm sure nothing like this would ever occur to you. Perfectionism. Perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor, the enemy of the people. It will keep you cramped and insane your whole life. And it is the main obstacle between you and a shitty first draft. I think perfectionism is based on the obsessive belief that if you run carefully enough, hitting each stepping stone just right, you won't have to die. The truth is that you will die anyway, and that a lot of people who aren't even looking at their feet are going to do a whole lot better than you, and have a lot more fun while they're doing it. Besides, perfectionism will ruin your writing, blocking inventiveness and playfulness and life force. These are words we are allowed to use in California. Perfectionism means that you are trying desperately not to leave so much mess to clean up. But clutter and mess show us that life is being lived. Clutter is wonderfully fertile ground. You can still discover new treasures under all those piles. Clean things up, edit things out, fix things, get a grip. Tidiness suggests that something is as good as it's going to get. Tidiness makes me think of held breath, of suspended animation, while writing needs to breathe and move. When I was 21, I had my tonsils removed. I was one of those people who got strep throat every 5 minutes, and my doctor finally decided that I needed to have my tonsils taken out. For the entire week afterwards, swallowing hurt so much that I could barely open my mouth for a straw. I had a prescription for painkillers, though, and when they ran out but the pain hadn't, I called the nurse and said that she would really need to send another prescription over and maybe a little mixed grill of drugs because I was also feeling somewhat anxious. But she wouldn't. I asked to speak to her supervisor. She told me her supervisor was at lunch and that I needed to buy some gum, of all things, and to chew it vigorously, the thought of which made me clutch at my throat. She explained that when we have a wound in our body, the nearby muscles cramp around it to protect it from any more violation and from infection, and that I would need to use these muscles if I wanted them to relax again. So finally, my best friend Pammy went out and bought me some gum, and I began to chew it with great hostility and skepticism. The first bites caused a ripping sensation in the back of my throat. But within minutes, all the pain was gone. Permanently. I think that something similar happens with our psychic muscles. They cramp around our wounds. The pain from our childhood, the losses and disappointments of adulthood, the humiliation suffered in both. To keep us from getting hurt in the same place again, to keep foreign substances out. So those wounds never have a chance to heal. Perfectionism is one way our muscles cramp. In some cases, we don't even know that the wounds and the cramping are there, but both limit us. They keep us moving and riding in tight, worried ways. They keep us standing back or backing away from life, keep us from experiencing life in a naked and immediate way. So how do we break through them and get on? It's easier if you believe in God, but not impossible if you don't. If you believe, then this God of yours might be capable of relieving you of some of this perfectionism. Still, one of the most annoying things about God is that he never just touches you with his magic wand, like Glinda the Good, and gives you what you want. Like it would be so much skin off his nose. But he might give you the courage or the stamina to write lots and lots of terrible first drafts, and then you'd learn that good second drafts can spring from these, and you'd see that big, sloppy, imperfect messes have value. Now, it might be that your God is an uptight, judgmental perfectionist, sort of like Bob Dole, or, for that matter, me. But a priest friend of mine has cautioned me away from the standard God of our childhoods, who loves and guides you, and then if you are bad, roasts you. God is high school principal in a gray suit who never remembered your name but is always leafing unhappily through your files. If this is your God, maybe you need to blend in the influence of someone who is ever so slightly more amused by you. Someone less anal. David Byrne is good, for instance. Gracie Allen is good. Mr. Rogers will work. If you don't believe in God, it may help to remember this great line of Jeanine Roth's. That awareness is learning to keep yourself company. And then learn to be more compassionate company, as if you were somebody you were fond of and wish to encourage. I doubt that you would read a close friend's early efforts and, in his or her presence, roll your eyes and snicker. I doubt that you would pantomime sticking your finger down your throat. I think you might say something along the lines of, "Good for you. We can work out some of the problems later, but for now, full steam ahead." In any case, the bottom line is that if you want to write, you get to, but you probably won't be able to get very far if you don't start trying to get over your perfectionism. You set out to tell a story of some sort, to tell the truth as you feel it, because something is calling you to do so. It calls you like the beckoning finger of smoke in cartoons that rises off the pie cooling on the windowsill, slides under doors and into mouse holes or into the nostrils of the sleeping man or woman in the easy chair. Then the aromatic smoke crooks its finger, and the mouse or the man or woman rises and follows, nose in the air. But some days the smoke is faint, and you just have to follow it as best you can, sniffing away. Still, even on those days, you might notice how great perseverance feels. And the next day, the scent may seem stronger. Or it may just be that you are developing a quiet doggedness. This is priceless. Perfectionism, on the other hand, will only drive you mad. Your day's work might turn out to have been a mess. So what? Vonnegut said, "When I write, I feel like an armless, legless man with a crayon in his mouth."
So go ahead and make big scrawls and mistakes. Use up lots of paper. Perfectionism is a mean, frozen form of idealism, while messes are the artist's true friend. What people somehow, inadvertently, I'm sure, forgot to mention when we were children was that we need to make messes in order to find out who we are and why we're here, and by extension, what we're supposed to be writing. School lunches. I know I set out to tell you every single thing I know about writing, but I'm also going to tell you every single thing I know about school lunches. Partly because the longings and dynamics and anxieties are so similar. I think this will also show how taking short assignments and then producing really shitty first drafts of these assignments can yield a bounty of detailed memory, raw material, and strange characters lurking in the shadows. So, sometimes when a student calls and is mewling and puking about the hopelessness of trying to put words down on paper, I ask him or her to tell me about school lunches. At parochial schools, private schools, 20 years earlier than mine, or 10 years later in Southern California or New York, and they always turn out to be similar to my middle-class Northern California public school lunches. But in important ways, they are different, too. And this is even more interesting, for the obvious reason that when we study the differences, we see in bolder relief what we have in common. And for some strange reason, when my students start to jam with me about school lunches, they get off the phone feeling more enthusiastic and in better shape. One time, in one of my classes, I asked my students to write about lunches for half an hour, and I sat down with them and wrote, "Here is the main thing I know about public school lunches. It only looked like a bunch of kids eating lunch. It was really about opening our insides in front of everyone, just like writing is. It was a precursor of the showers in 7th and 8th grade gym, where everyone could see your everything or your lack of everything and smell the inside smells of your body, and the whole time you just knew you were going to catch something. The contents of your lunch said whether or not you and your family were okay. Some bag lunches, like some people, were okay and some weren't. There was a code, a right and acceptable way. It was that simple." But in half an hour, there was already too much material for me and some of the people in class, and it threatened to immobilize us. So we decided not to even bother with our parents' handwriting on the outside of the brown paper lunch bag, how much it resembled a Turkish assassin's and what that said about us. We decided to set aside the bag itself for a moment. For the time being, we'd stick with the contents and, to begin with, the sandwich. That was the one-inch picture frame we were going to look through. Your sandwich was the centerpiece, and there were strict guidelines. It almost goes without saying that store-bought white bread was the only acceptable bread. There were no exceptions. If your mother made the white bread for your sandwich, you could only hope that no one would notice. You certainly did not brag about it any more than you would brag that she also made head cheese. And there were only a few things that your parents could put in between the two pieces of bread. Bologna was fine, salami and unaggressive cheese were fine, peanut butter and jelly were fine if your parents understood the jelly-jam issue. Grape jelly was best, by far, a nice, slippery, comforting, sugary, petroleum product grape. Strawberry jam was second. Everything else was iffy. Take raspberry, for instance. Now, see, I couldn't remember, as I wrote in class, just exactly what it was about raspberry jam that was so disconcerting. So, when I got home that night, I called a friend who is also a writer, very successful and maybe the most neurotic person I know. I said, "Remember how in elementary school, grape jelly was best in your lunch, strawberry jam was okay, but raspberry was real borderline? Can you talk to me about your experiences with these things?" And my friend went into an impassioned, disoriented riff about how there was too much happening in raspberry jam, too many seeds per spoonful. It felt like there were all these tiny little pod people in it. It was body snatcher jam. My friend then mentioned apricot jam, which was even worse than raspberry. I had not thought about this in 30 years, but now it all came back with horrible clarity. Apricot jam looked too much like glue or mucilage, but you could count on having apricot jam when your father made the lunch. Fathers loved apricot jam. I don't know why, but I'm sure Anna Freud could have a field day with it. I sat down that night and kept writing. In general, come to think of it, when fathers made lunches, things always turned out badly. Fathers were so oblivious back then. They were like foreigners. For instance, a code bologna sandwich meant white bread, one or two slices of bologna, mustard, one wilted piece of iceberg lettuce. The Catholics were heavily into mayonnaise, which we might get into later. Fathers, to begin with, always used non-regulation bread and then buttered it, which made the sandwich about as tradable as a plate of haggis. Also, everything was always falling out of the sandwiches fathers made. I'm not sure why. They'd use anything green and frilly for lettuce when, of course, only the one piece of wilted iceberg was permissible. Your friends saw a big leaf of romaine falling out along with a slice of bologna, and you might soon find yourself alongside the kid against the fence. There was always that one kid against the fence. How could the rest of us feel okay if there wasn't? If it was a guy, there was probably a trumpet case at his feet, and he wore strangely scuffed shoes because he avoided the foot traffic on sidewalks and walked instead through weedy lots with dogs yipping at him. He didn't end up at the station only because his lunches were nightmarish in their eccentricity, but his lunches didn't help. He almost certainly ended up being a writer. Now, who knows if any of this is usable material? There's no way to tell until you've got it all down, and then there might just be one sentence or one character or one theme that you end up using. But you get it all down. You just write. I heard Natalie Goldberg, the author of Writing Down the Bones, speak on writing once. Someone asked her for the best possible writing advice she had to offer, and she held up a yellow legal pad, pretended her fingers held a pen, and scribbled away. I think this was some sort of Zen reference, the Buddhist disciple remembering Buddha's flower sermon, in which all Buddha did was hold up a flower and twirl it in silence sitting on a mountain. Me, I'm a nice Christian girl, and while I wish I could quote something kicky and inspirational that Jesus had to say about writing, the truth is that when students ask me for the best practical advice I know, I always pick up a piece of paper and pantomime scribbling away. My students usually think this is a very wise and Zen-like thing for me to convey. Mostly, I forget to give Natalie Goldberg credit. But write about what? They ask next. Write about carrot sticks, I tell them. Code carrots had to look machine extruded, absolutely uniform, none longer than the length of the sandwich. Your parents would sometimes send you to school with waxed paper packets of uneven cuckoo bunny carrots, and your carrot esteem would be so low you couldn't even risk looking at the guy against the fence. Bad juju. If you so much as glanced at him, a visual, empathetic arc would stretch between you, almost like a rainbow, and link you two in the minds of your peers forever. And then there was the matter of the wrapping paper. Waxed paper and later saran wrap. If code lunches were about that intense desire for one thing in life to be okay, or even just to appear to be okay, when all around you and at home and inside you things were so chaotic and painful, then it mattered that it not look like Jughead had wrapped your sandwich. A code lunch suggested that someone in your family was paying attention, even if in your heart you knew that your parents were screwing up left and right. So it was a little like making your bed at lunch. Everything should be squared. Sandwiches should be wrapped with hospital corners. Right? Okay, that's all. But now I have this material to choose from, to work with, to shape, edit, highlight, or toss. And that's very nice of you to suggest the latter. This is my version of school lunches. Yours might be different, and I would be interested in hearing about it. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting you mail it to me, but I bet it reveals some interesting stuff about you and your family and the times in which you grew up. And even though what I've quoted here is shitty first draft stuff, the boy against the fence appeared out of nowhere. I had no idea when I started writing that he was in my memory. To me, he is the most important thing that came out of this exercise. Tomorrow, when I sit down to work on my novel, he will be someone who matters to me, whom I want to work with, get to know, who has something important to say, or somewhere only he can take me. Polaroids. Writing a first draft is very much like watching a Polaroid develop. You can't, and in fact you're not supposed to, know exactly what the picture is going to look like until it has finished developing. First, you just point out what has your attention and take the picture. In the last chapter, for instance, what had my attention were the contents of my lunch bag. But as the picture developed, I found I had a really clear image of the boy against the fence. Or maybe your Polaroid was supposed to be a picture of that boy against the fence, and you didn't notice until the last minute that a family was standing a few feet away from him. Now, maybe it's his family, or the family of one of the kids in his class, but at any rate, these people are going to be in the photograph, too. Then the film emerges from the camera with a grayish-green murkiness that gradually becomes clearer and clearer. And finally, you see the husband and wife holding their baby with two children standing beside them. And at first, it all seems very sweet. But then the shadows begin to appear. And then you start to see the animal tragedy, the baboons baring their teeth. And then you see a flash of bright red flowers in the bottom left quadrant that you didn't even know were in the picture when you took it. And these flowers evoke a time or a memory that moves you mysteriously. And finally, as the portrait comes into focus, you begin to notice all the props surrounding these people. And you begin to understand how props define us and comfort us and show us what we value and what we need and who we think we are. You couldn't have had any way of knowing what this piece of work would look like when you first started. You just knew that there was something about these people that compelled you, and you stayed with that something long enough for it to show you what it was about. Watch this Polaroid develop. 6 or 7 years ago, I was asked to write an article on the Special Olympics. I had been going to the local event for years, partly because a couple of friends of mine compete. Also, I love sports. I love to watch athletes, special or otherwise. So I showed up this time with a great deal of interest, but no real sense of what the finished article might look like. Things tend to go very, very slowly at the Special Olympics. It is not like trying to cover the Preakness. Still, it has its own exhilaration, and I cheered and took notes all morning. The last track and field event before lunch was a 25-yard race run by some unusually handicapped runners and walkers, many of whom seemed completely confused. They lumped and careened along, one man making a snail-slow break for the stands, one heading out toward the steps where the winners received their medals. Both of them were shepherded back. The race took just about forever, and here it was, nearly noon, and we were all so hungry. Finally, though, everyone crossed over the line, and those of us in the stands got up to go, when we noticed that way down the track, 4 or 5 yards from the starting line, was another runner. She was a girl of about 16, with a normal-looking face above a racked and emaciated body. She was on metal crutches, and she was just plugging along, one tiny step after another, moving one crutch forward 2 or 3 inches, then moving a leg, then moving the other crutch 2 or 3 inches, then moving the other leg. It was just excruciating. Plus, I was starving to death. Inside, I was going, come on, come on, come on, swabbing at my forehead with anxiety, while she kept taking these 2 or 3 inch steps forward. What felt like 4 hours later, she crossed the finish line, and you could see that she was absolutely stoked in a shy, girlish way. A tall African-American man with no front teeth fell into step with me as I left the bleachers to go look for some lunch. He tugged on the sleeve of my sweater, and I looked up at him, and he handed me a Polaroid someone had taken of him and his friends that day. "Look at us," he said. His speech was difficult to understand, thick and slow as a warped record. His two friends in the picture had Down syndrome. All three of them looked extremely pleased with themselves. I admired the picture and then handed it back to him. He stopped, so I stopped too. He pointed to his own image. "That," he said, "is one cool man." And this was the image from which an article began forming. Although I could not have told you exactly what the piece would end up being about, I just knew that something had started to emerge. After lunch, I wandered over to the auditorium, where it turned out a men's basketball game was in progress. The African-American man with no front teeth was the star of the game. You could tell that he was, because even though no one had made a basket yet, his teammates almost always passed him the ball. Even the people on the other team passed him the ball a lot. In lieu of any scoring, the men stampeded in slow motion up and down the court, dribbling the ball thunderously. I had never heard such a loud game. It was all sort of crazily beautiful. I imagined describing the game for my article, and then for my students, the loudness, the joy. I kept replaying the scene of the girl on crutches making her way up the track to the finish line, and all of a sudden my article began to appear out of the grayish-green murk. And I could see that it was about tragedy, transformed over the years into joy. It was about the beauty of sheer effort. I could see it almost as clearly as I could the photograph of that one cool man and his friends. The auditorium bleachers were packed. Then, a few minutes later, still with no score on the board, the tall black man dribbled slowly from one end of the court to the other and heaved the ball up into the air, and it dropped into the basket. The crowd roared, and all the men on both teams looked up wide-eyed at the hoop as if it had just burst into flames. "You would have loved it," I tell my students. "You would have felt like you could write all day." Character. Knowledge of your characters also emerges the way a Polaroid develops. It takes time for you to know them. One image that helps me begin to know the people in my fiction is something a friend once told me. She said that every single one of us, at birth, is given an emotional acre all our own. You get one. Your awful Uncle Phil gets one. I get one. Trisha Nixon gets one. Everyone gets one. And as long as you don't hurt anyone, you really get to do with your acre as you please. You can plant fruit trees or flowers or alphabetized rows of vegetables or nothing at all. If you want your acre to look like a giant garage sale or an auto wrecking yard, that's what you get to do with it. There's a fence around your acre, though, with a gate. And if people keep coming onto your land and sliming it or trying to get you to do what they think is right, you get to ask them to leave. And they have to go, because this is your acre. By the same token, each of your characters has an emotional acre that they tend, or don't tend, in certain specific ways. One of the things you want to discover as you start out is what each person's acre looks like. What is the person growing? And what sort of shape is the land in? This knowledge may not show up, per se, in what you write, but the point is that you need to find out as much as possible about the interior life of the people you're working with. Now, you also want to ask yourself how they stand, what they carry in their pockets or purses, what happens in their faces and to their posture when they are thinking or bored or afraid. Whom would they have voted for last time? Why should we care about them anyway? What would be the first thing they stopped doing if they found out they had 6 months to live? Would they start smoking again? Would they keep flossing? You're going to love some of your characters because they are you or some facet of you, and you're going to hate some of your characters for the same reason. But no matter what, you are probably going to have to let bad things happen to some of the characters you love, or you won't have much of a story. Bad things happen to good characters because our actions have consequences and we do not all behave perfectly all the time. As soon as you start protecting your characters from the ramifications of their less than lofty behavior, your story will start to feel flat and pointless, just like in real life. Get to know your characters as well as you can. Let there be something at stake, and then let the chips fall where they may. My Al-Anon friend told me about the frazzled, defeated wife of an alcoholic man who kept passing out on the front lawn in the middle of the night. The wife kept dragging him in before dawn so that the neighbors wouldn't see him, until finally an old black woman from the South came up to her one day after a meeting and said, "Honey, leave him lay where Jesus flang him." And I am slowly, slowly in my work, and even more slowly in real life, learning to do this. A man I know once said to me, "The evidence is in, and you are the verdict." This will be true for each of your characters. The evidence will be in, and each of them will be his or her own verdict. But you may not know what this verdict is at first. You may only know your characters' externals instead of their essences. Don't worry about it. More will be revealed over time. In the meantime, can you see what your people look like? What sort of first impression do they make? What does each one care about, want more than anything in the world? What are their secrets? How do they move? How do they smell? Everyone is walking around as an advertisement for who he or she is. So, who is this person? Show us. Whatever your characters do or say will be born out of who they are. So you need to set out to get to know each one as well as possible. One way to do this is to look within your own heart at the different facets of your personality. You may find a con man, an orphan, a nurse, a king, a hooker, a preacher, a loser, a child, a crone. Get into each of these people and try to capture how each one feels, thinks, talks, survives. Another way to familiarize yourself with your characters is to base them partly on someone you know, a model from real life or a composite. Your Uncle Edgar, but with the nervous tics and the odd smell of this guy you observe for 10 minutes in line at the post office. Squint at these characters in your mind, and then start to paint them for us. Pages and pages of straight description, though, will probably wear us out. See if you can hear what they would say, and how they would say it. One line of dialogue that rings true reveals character in a way that pages of description can't. How would your main characters describe their current circumstances to a close friend, before and then after a few drinks? See if you can take dictation from them as they tell you who they think they are and what life has been like lately. Here is a passage by André Debus that I always pass out to my students when we first begin to talk about character. I love short stories because I believe they are the way we live. They are what our friends tell us in their pain and joy, their passion and rage, their yearning and their cry against injustice. We can sit all night with our friend while he talks about the end of his marriage, and what we finally get is a collection of stories about passion, tenderness, misunderstanding, sorrow, money, those hours and days and moments when he was absolutely married, whether he and his wife were screaming at each other, or sulking around the house, or making love. While his marriage was dying, he was also working, spending evenings with friends rearing children. But those are other stories. Which is why, days after hearing a painful story by a friend, we see him and say, "How are you?" We know that by now he may have another story to tell, or he may be in the middle of one, and we hope it is joyful. Think of the basket of each character's life. What holds the ectoplasm together? What are this person's routines, beliefs? What little things would your characters write in their journals? "I ate this, I hate that, I did this, I took the dog for a long walk, I chatted with my neighbor." This is all the stuff that tethers them to the earth and to other people. All the stuff that makes each character think that life sort of makes sense. The basket is an apt image because of all the holes. How aware is each character of how flimsy the basket really is? How present are your people? Someone once said to me, "I'm trying to learn to stay in the now. Not the last now, not the next now, this now." Which now do your characters dwell in? What are your characters teaching their children by example and by indoctrination? For instance, I was teaching Sam peace chants for a long time when he was only 2. It was during the war in the Persian Gulf. I was a little angry. "What do we want?" I'd call to Sam. "Peace," he'd shout dutifully. "And when do we want it?" I'd ask. "Now," he'd say. And I'd smile and toss him a fish. The words were utterly meaningless to him, of course. I might as well have taught him to reply, "Spooze," instead of "peace," and "August," instead of "now." My friends loved it, though. All 3 of his grandparents loved it. Now, how much does this say about me and my longings? I think something like this would tell a reader more about a character than with 3 pages of description. It would tell us about her current politics and the political tradition from which she sprang, her people-pleasing, her longing for peace and her longing to belong, her way of diluting rage and frustration with humor while also using her child as a prop, a little live Charlie McCarthy. The latter is horrifying, but it's also sort of poignant. Maybe 35 years ago this woman had to perform for her parents' friends. Maybe she was their little Charlie McCarthy. Maybe she and her therapist can discuss it for the next few months. And did this woman stop using her kid when she realized what she was doing? No, she didn't. And this tells us even more. She kept at it long after the war was over, until one day she called to her 3-and-a-half-year-old son, "Hey, what do we want?" And he said plaintively, "Lunch." I once asked Ethan Kanan to tell me the most valuable thing he knew about writing, and without hesitation he said, "Nothing is as important as a likable narrator. Nothing holds the story together better." I think he's right. If your narrator is someone whose take on things fascinates you, it isn't really going to matter if nothing much happens for a long time. I could watch John Cleese or Anthony Hopkins do dishes for about an hour without needing much else to happen. Having a likable narrator is like having a great friend whose company you love, whose mind you love to pick, whose running commentary totally holds your attention, who makes you laugh out loud, whose lines you always want to steal. When you have a friend like this, she can say, "Hey, I've got to drive up to the dump in Petaluma. Want to come along?" And you honestly can't think of anything in the world you'd rather do. By the same token, a boring or annoying person can offer to buy you an expensive dinner followed by tickets to a great show, and in all honesty, you'd rather stay home and watch the Aspic set. Now, a person's faults are largely what make him or her likable. I like for narrators to be like the people I choose for friends, which is to say that they have a lot of the same flaws as I. Preoccupation with self is good, as is a tendency toward procrastination, self-delusion, darkness, jealousy, groveling, greediness, addictiveness. They shouldn't be too perfect. Perfect means shallow and unreal and fatally uninteresting. I like for them to have a nice, sick sense of humor and to be concerned with important things, by which I mean that they are interested in political and psychological and spiritual matters. I want them to want to know who we are and what life is all about. I like them to be mentally ill in the same sorts of ways that I am. For instance, I have a friend who said one day, "I could resent the ocean if I tried," and I realized that I love that in a guy. I like for them to have hope. If a friend or a narrator reveals himself or herself to be hopeless too early on, I lose interest. It depresses me, makes me overeat. I don't mind if a person has no hope if he or she is sufficiently funny about the whole thing. But then, this being able to be funny definitely speaks of a kind of hope, of buoyancy. Novels ought to have hope. At least American novels ought to have hope. French novels don't need to. We mostly win wars, they lose them. Of course, they did hide more Jews than many other countries, and this is a form of winning. Although, as my friend Jane points out, if you or I had been there speaking really bad French, they would have turned us in a hot second. Bank on it. In general, though, there's no point in writing hopeless novels. We all know we're going to die. What's important is the kind of men and women we are in the face of this. Sometimes people turn out to be not all that funny or articulate, but they can still be great friends or narrators if they possess a certain clarity of vision, especially if they have survived or are in the process of surviving a great deal. This is inherently interesting material, since this is the task before all of us. Sometimes we have to have one hand on this rock here, one hand on that one, and each big toe seeking out firm, if temporary, footing, and while we're scaling that rock face, there's no time for bubbles, champagne, and a witty aside. You don't mind that people in this situation are not being charming. You are glad to see them doing something you will need to do down the line, and with dignity. The challenge and the dignity make it interesting enough. Besides, deciding what is interesting is about as subjective as things get. People hand me books and articles to read that they promise are fascinating, and I wake up holding the book with a jerk, like when you wake up from a little nap at the movies, thinking that you're falling out of an airplane. Here for me is the last word on interesting, from a short story by Abigail Thomas. My mother's first criterion for a man is that he be interesting. What this really means is that he be able to appreciate my mother, whose jokes hinge on some grammatical subtlety, or a working knowledge of higher mathematics. You get the picture. Robbie is about as interesting as a pair of red high-top Converse